It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state legislature is back in Madison, the first floor period since the end of the budget writing process this summer. Now lawmakers are crafting bills with the hope of Governor Evers signing them into law by the end of the year.
And as lawmakers go about their business, there are fears among Wisconsinites and people around the country that we're in a period of growing political violence and that threats and online rhetoric could escalate.
To look at this and other issues, we have Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He's a Republican who represents Racine County and the surrounding area in southeast Wisconsin. Speaker Voss, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. In this time of violence and uncertainty, what is changing at the state capitol?
Actually, not a whole lot. We've had a pretty good relationship between the executive and the judicial and the legislative branch as far as making sure that we tone down the rhetoric. There are certainly things I disagree with Tony Evers on, but I think he's a good, decent person. We don't go after each other personally. And I think that, yes, the rhetoric gets heated sometimes, but it's nowhere near the level that we're seeing perhaps in some other places.
Well, that is rhetoric. What about security as you reflect on Representative Jerry O'Connor receiving death threats last week over his comments in support of a bill that would block gay pride flags from being flown at state buildings?
Well, they wouldn't just block gay pride flags. They'd also block MAGA flags. So the idea was to say that the only flags that should fly over government buildings are flags that unify us, not divide us. And I think that goes right back to the heart of your question, which is we need things that bring people together, not things that drive them apart. So I don't believe we want to make the Capitol into an armed fortress. If you look at what happened to my colleague, Representative Hortman in Minnesota, that happened in her home. If you look at what happened to Charlie Kirk, that happened on a college campus. So the idea that we're going to make a single building in the state into a fortress and somehow make people feel safer gives them a false sense of security. So I think we just need to make sure that we are aware of our surroundings all the time and that if there are threats, we take them seriously, like we did with Representative O'Connor, but to not make it into one place being somehow this fortress while everywhere else allows people to be a target.
Is that the same for the state Supreme Court, which has asked for additional security for two sessions in a row now that Republicans have rejected?
It'd be the same for us, exactly, which is that if you're inside the Capitol, you are safe. We have our own Capitol Police Force. If you're at home, you certainly have the ability to have a security system. We're actually looking at doing some of those kind of things. But to form a separate police force for each branch of government, I think that's a waste of taxpayer money.
Say a little more there. You've said you might allow your colleagues to use their office budget allocations to pay for security at their homes. What do you mean by that?
One of the things that we had talked about is each legislator and each branch of government is given the opportunity to have money that they spend on things that are a priority for them. It could be mailing to your office. It could be doing district outreach. And we had talked about, but I haven't yet adopted, the idea of saying that if somebody wanted to install a security system into their home, so that somebody couldn't break in or a panic alarm, we'd certainly be open to discussing that idea. But again, the concept of having our own police force or doing something that's way outside the norm probably isn't going to fly, but we're certainly wanting to make sure that people are safe no matter where they are.
Okay, turning to the work now inside the Capitol, the legislature and Governor Evers have passed big bipartisan bills in the last couple sessions. You've been in the middle of that with shared revenue. Recall the Brewer Stadium funding, most recently the two-year state budget on July 3rd. Do you anticipate other big bipartisan compromises before the session adjourns?
Topics that we're going through, we're focusing on education. I was disappointed that Governor Evers didn't want to take advantage of the federal budget, which, you can argue about the Big Beautiful Bill if you'd like every part of it, but there are parts of there that I think certainly make sense for the country. And one of those is saying that if you want to make a donation to an educational institution, could be private, could be public, the federal government will help by giving extra money to that institution. I don't know why we wouldn't want to help our public schools. So I'm hoping that in the end, we have an opportunity to come together on that. We have some task forces that we've announced on things like protecting kids from access to technology and social media, which we know increases the risk for suicide and social isolation. We have a task force on elder services, another one on making government more efficient by using technology, and another one on the rulemaking process to ensure we have oversight of the bureaucracy. So all of those should be bipartisan in addition to our work on a teacher bill of rights and all kinds of other good things. So, yeah, I hope there's a lot of possibility for compromise and finding middle ground. But again, it takes two to tango, and we are more than willing to dance.
And so you cut out there for briefly at the beginning. Do you anticipate then these task forces that you have just formed are going to be able to carry through and get some really important legislation? And if so, what?
That's my hope. I mean, let's just take the one example of protecting kids. What we've done in the past, and I've done these for about 10 years, as long as I've been speaker, we have a Democrat and a Republican lead each of the task forces to try to find bipartisan consensus. So the one, let's just take one, as I talked about with access to technology, we know that the way that kids are interacting with social media is harmful to their mental health, and it certainly is creating long-term problems for society. So we passed a bill in the Assembly, which would have required every school district to have a policy on no cell phones in school. I would have preferred more of a mandate to say that there are no cell phones in school, because we know all the research that we have seen shows that it improves educational outcome for kids, and it actually makes the school in many ways a better environment for children and the teachers. But the Senate still has to act on that. So hopefully they'll bring that up this fall. We have another bill that would actually make it a little bit easier for dual enrollment, where we want kids to be able to do college credit in high school, to be able to transfer and hopefully drive down the cost of higher education. And lastly, we have an important bill on the Teacher Bill of Rights. There are far too many teachers that are seeing an exodus from the profession because of the environment that's been created inside the classroom, where children aren't held accountable, teachers aren't given the support that they need, and we have a long-term problem. So I think there's a lot of issues that we'll be able to find that consensus on, again, as long as people are willing to have the open conversation.
When you say teachers aren't getting the support they need in terms of pay?
No, it's not about money. It's really about the support of the administration and making sure that when kids act out in the classroom, they are not sent to the principal's office and 5 minutes later sent right back. We need to make sure that in the classroom, teachers are supported so they feel safe from students who act out, and also supported from parents who many times are overly involved in the minutia of the classroom, as opposed to when I was younger, if I did something wrong, the assumption was that the child made the mistake. And far too many times, the parents take the side of their toddler over the teacher, and that creates a huge burden on the process. So we just want to have a conversation to say, how do we support teachers? How do we do a better job of making sure that education happens in the classroom, and that we don't allow this craziness of some of these parents who are overinvolved to drive folks out of the profession?
We're talking with Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss about the latest from the state capitol. Speaker Voss, historically, a president's party, the sitting White House, almost always loses ground in midterm House elections. In our state, all, as you know, 99 seats in the Assembly will be up for grabs in the election. Could the Assembly be won or lost, depending on how people feel about President Trump?
I mean, it's certainly possible after the gerrymander that was ordered by the new liberal Supreme Court. If you remember, the districts were all found to be constitutional by every court in the state and the country until we had the flip of the Supreme Court with liberals gaining control, and all of a sudden they had to rewrite the districts. They're still competitive. We still won 54 of 99 seats, even as they gerrymandered the map. So we try to work together. I think we've had good things for the state of Wisconsin. Is it possible that because of the huge amount of out-of-state money that comes in to flood the state from liberal special interests and the fact that they were gerrymandered by this partisan court, is it possible that it could flip? Sure, it's possible. But I think if you look at the track record, we have survived under maps drawn by every possible combination, all liberal, all conservative, a mix of the two. So I think we have a great record to stand on. And I think the Assembly will stay Republican for a good long time, because most people in Wisconsin like the fact that we have divided government. They like the fact that Tony Evers is required to negotiate with the Republicans and that we're required to do the same. Not bad for the state. And I hope in the end, people recognize that a trifecta of crazy liberals is not good for Wisconsin.
Before we have to let you go, Governor Evers accusing legislative Republicans of ignoring this recent state Supreme Court decision, the decision allowing state agencies like the DNR to carry out proposed rules before the Republican-led legislative committees finish reviewing them. What is your next step over the legal disputes on administrative rules?
Well, for anybody who's listening that thinks it's wrong for a person to be a king, our Supreme Court has basically said that the executive, whoever it is, a Republican or a Democrat, has the right to impose rules on the state with no oversight from other elected officials. That's wrong. It should never happen. I don't care if it was at the federal level with President Trump. It shouldn't happen under the state level with Tony Evers. So we want to have a discussion to say, how do we fix this process to ensure that the people are able to have their input, and it's not just a single person with a bunch of bureaucrats making decisions that have the force of law.
But if a rule doesn't move in committee, what is supposed to happen then?
Well, you compromise and you find a way to get it to go. The vast majority, I would say over 99% of the bills and the proposals move through the process. The fact that he doesn't get his way all of the time is why he is kind of stomping his foot right now. I don't think that's what people in Wisconsin want. They want us to compromise. They want us to find middle ground, and that's what we're attempting to do.
In our last few moments here, do you anticipate a potential constitutional amendment over this issue?
It's certainly possible. Again, I would rather have us compromise and find a way to be able to make it work under current law. But if for some reason they won't work with us, yeah, that's always a possibility.
Assembly Speaker Voss, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having us on. Bye-bye.
Bye. Robin Voss, Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, and we've been talking about the latest developments inside the Capitol and growing concerns about political violence.
Now, a new partnership in Wisconsin aims to boost coverage of Native American communities. Journalists are often criticized for the way that they've covered Native Americans and for the lack of attention they give to tribal issues.
That led Tim Gallego to found the first independent Native American newspaper, the Lakota Times, in 1981. It evolved into Indian Country Today, which was later rebranded as ICT. It's now part of a larger nonprofit organization, Indige Public Media.
In partnership with PBS Wisconsin, Indige created an Indigenous Affairs reporter position here in the state. That reporter joins us now. Erica Aisi covers the 12 tribes in Wisconsin and reports for both Here and Now and ICT. Also with us, Katie Oyen, member of the Oglala Sioux tribe who reported for the Associated Press for 20 years. She's the chief executive officer of Indige Public Media. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. Great to be here.
And Erica, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Erica, there are 12 tribes in Wisconsin located all over the state. You're covering a lot of ground here, clearly. How do you approach this beat with so many different voices, issues, and geographies that come into play?
Yeah, I think approaching this beat right off the bat, the heart of it is with the collaboration with ICT, formerly Indian Country Today. So because the state does have 12 tribes and we're trying to really hear directly from the tribes what their issues are, collaborating with them brings a deeper sense of knowledge, especially with the other reporters that have worked in and around this area and nationwide. And when we're brainstorming stories, there's always the question, what is the Wisconsin angle? And of course, each tribe is different and they're not a monolith. But what hasn't been covered from particular tribes? And they're really far and spread really all over the state. And I think with that, the collaboration with them and bringing in that expertise early on, we're able to hone in on what tribes you want to cover for a particular time or reason, and then brainstorm and see, let's get to the heart of it and who are our sources and who's going to help us tell this story.
And Erica, part of the value of a beat of any kind is, you know, you're not just bopping in on one story. You get to know people over time and know the territory. How have you worked to build relationships with the people you're covering?
Before I was even went out and reporting, we started with, let's just have meet and greets with different tribes without any cameras, and let's get together and just sit down and build relationships. So that's what I did, was that when I started, we weren't really focused on one particular story. It was just building relationships with the tribes. And I started with Menominee and traveled to Menominee. And because of the relationship with ICT and the various productions that happen here at PBS Wisconsin, we were able to link directly with tribal leaders and youth activists and go to the tribes and set up a time. I think I was there for maybe 2 or 3 days where I introduced myself at the tribal offices and told them our intent on this collaboration and what we aim to do and hear with the tribes. And I was also able to hear directly from them, what are the stories that have been covered? How can media do it differently? And what's next? What are the stories that have not been covered? And how can we work together to tell those stories?
Katie, what do you see as the value of these partnerships with Indige Media and groups like PBS Wisconsin?
We see tremendous value in these relationships, and I think that the great work that Eric has been doing just shows the value that we can bring when we work together in ways like this. I think that at ICT, We've always understood the deep importance of reporting, not just for Native communities, but from Native communities. And we've been working very hard to expand our geographical footprint so that we can cover even more tribal communities across the country. And it takes partnerships. We recognize that we can't do it on our own, and we just are really grateful for PBS Wisconsin stepping up and sharing a reporter with us like this in this way. It's been, like I said, just tremendously valuable, and the work that Erica has done just shows that.
Does this, Katie, seem to you like a blueprint for the future? You're going to be looking to develop more of these kind of partnerships?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We have a couple of other partnerships that are somewhat similar to this, but I think, you know, heading into the future, we're always looking to aggressively expand our geographical coverage area and absolutely looking for more ways to pair with other media organizations.
Erica, you've already done in the last almost year now several reports for PBS Wisconsin and ICT, the impacts of federal funding cuts, Indigenous language programs and music, the list goes on. Are there issues you see facing tribes in Wisconsin that are particular to our state?
Sure, I'll mention two. MMIW, so you may hear that acronym a lot in Indigenous reporting. So that stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, and has also unfortunately extended to MMMIR, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives. It is an epidemic happening across the country, but being able to do that story in early May to hone it in to let people know, unfortunately, this is happening in Wisconsin. And that's a story that we covered in May as Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Day, and there was a rally here on the Capitol, and that's a story that we looked at specifically from the Wisconsin perspective and how local police and tribal police are having problems on both ends gathering the data to get to the core and root of this problem. So that's a story that's specific to Wisconsin. Also, the story that's growing and developing and longstanding in Bad River and the issue with the Enbridge pipeline and how that is impacting tribes, specifically the Bad River tribe with tribal sovereignty and water sovereignty and protecting their environment. So those are two stories that are very specific and key that are happening here in Wisconsin.
We're talking about media coverage of Native American communities and partnerships to boost that coverage. Erica Aisi is Indigenous Affairs Multimedia Reporter for PBS Wisconsin's Here and Now and ICT. And Katie Oyen is Chief Executive Officer of Indige Public Media. Katie, what do we in the mainstream media miss, do you think, when it comes to covering Native American communities and issues?
Well, that is a great question. Thank you for asking. I think that that question is actually kind of core to our existence as Indige Public Media and ICT News. We were founded over 40 years ago around this idea of taking ownership of our own stories. And I think that historically we have seen, you know, the perpetuation of harmful stereotypes and a focus on deficit-based reporting, various issues with other media telling our stories. But I will say today, I feel like we face a whole new set of challenges. It's not so much today looking at it in terms of us versus them as it is about us versus the decline of the local news ecosystem, attacks on press freedoms and what that means for our democracy, and also the spread of misinformation online and the rise in the number of people who are primarily getting their news from social media influencers. So looking at it through a slightly different lens today, but I do think that one of the positive changes that we've seen come out of this is just much more of a collaborative spirit among newsrooms and much more of this idea that we're all in this together, we're sharing resources, we're sharing our content, and we're, you know, all joining together to sort of meet this moment and to, you know, just tell good stories.
Erica, I understand you're not a tribal member yourself. What advice do you have, based on your experience doing this, to non-Native American reporters or outlets that are covering these communities?
Sure. I'm not a tribal member, but I am a woman of color. As a Black woman, I think, you know, in taking that extra step to make sure that not telling marginalized or stereotypical stories. And any advice I would give to a journalist that wants to tell an Indigenous story or have this as a full beat, first is to decolonize your mind in ways of story gathering. You know, we're used to and we're taught, you know, this perfect soundbite needs to fit in this perfect space, and I need to sit with this person for just this amount of times. So I have to run out and get this. Throw all of that out of the window when you're working with Indigenous communities. It's not about transactions. It's about relationships. An elder may sit with you for an hour before you actually get the actual answer for your story, and you have to be prepared for that. So if you're working on a story and you may think, I'm only going to travel for one day, maybe make it 2 days because it may take a little bit longer, and they may ask you to come back because they need to trust you and want to share with you a story and time and not something that's really short and brief just to fit into what you needed to fit into. So value relationships as you're working with Indigenous stories.
Katie, do you have thoughts on that? Because I have been the radio producer looking for a guest during this time slot at this time, need to hear back in the next half hour. Maybe that doesn't work well with Native communities or any community. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say it's about, you know, having those consistent relations, like building those relationships and maintaining that consistency so that perhaps you're not having to reach out just totally out of the blue and scrambling at the last minute. I understand, though. I understand. I've been there. I get it. And I would just add to what Erica was saying, you know, just going in informed and understanding not just the story you want to tell, but the context around it. A lot of times there's a lot of nuance and historical contexts that play into issues that Native people are facing today. Just as with any other source, go in with respect. And I'll also just note that there are other resources out there for journalists. I would recommend checking out the Indigenous Journalists Association website or reaching out to folks there. They're great and just a wealth of information and resources.
And we'll leave it there. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Erica, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Katie Oyen is Chief Executive Officer of Indige Public Media, and Erica Aisi covers the 12 tribes in Wisconsin and reports her both here and now on PBS Wisconsin and ICT. We've been talking about media coverage of Native American communities here in Wisconsin and around the country.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For the first time in 25 years, Madison will be getting a new public library. It's on the city's northeast side. Called the Imagination Center, the library will have a unique design located in a city park.
Plans for the library aim to make it a community hub in a part of the city that has historically been a resource desert.
Madison Public Library Director Tana Elias joins us for a look at the upcoming library and community involvement in its design. Tana, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by talking about the location of the new library, the Imagination Center. It's been described by some area residents as a resource desert. What kind of things pointed Madison Public Library to this location in particular?
Well, it all got started in 2016 when we released our East Side plan. We had been looking at library service on the East Side as compared to library service on the West Side. knowing that the East Side was growing. And the East Side of Madison also has much fewer public resources than the West Side does. So one of the things that we found in that study is that it was a resource desert. There are fewer public spaces for meetings. There are fewer spaces for free internet. There are fewer libraries for all the information resources that you find through libraries. But there were also fewer park shelters and other kinds of amenities that make a city livable and enjoyable. Less public art, for example. So this was something that had been mentioned as far back as 2007 as a desire for the library to have a location on the East Side and in the Rindell Park area. We found that was solidified through this East Side study. And then we went about the long and arduous process of getting all of the funding and buy-in that we needed to build the new facility.
Now, the old-fashioned view, I think, of libraries is, oh, it's a place for books and other materials, which libraries are, but a lot of other stuff goes on there, too. Community centers, job services, the list goes on and on. My understanding is the plan for this new library, the Imagination Center, is it's going to be built with a lot of those things in mind. Tell us what went into that design.
Yeah, so libraries have definitely changed in terms of the services that they offer. Like you mentioned, they are similar to a community center in a lot of ways. Every library that we have remodeled in the last decade or more has included more public space, more meeting rooms, individual study rooms, places for people to take teleconference appointments, for example. So just a wide variety of uses, in addition to the reading and learning that we know or associate with traditional public libraries. What we find is people will come to the library to check out resources, but also meet with others in their community or use the library's technology resources to meet with people online. And so we envision a spot that will offer all of those things, but it's also located in a park, which is pretty unique for Madison and unique for public libraries across the nation. And having a park pavilion nearby, like just really, you know, adjacent to the library, provides so many opportunities. That pavilion will be a space that families in the area can rent for celebrations in their lives, for community spaces, something that businesses can rent to host employee recognition events. And it will be really a transformative spot, I think, because of that adjacency, because we have library functions and park pavilion functions. And then just right outside our doors, we'll have the whole park. It's a very large park in the city of Madison, and it's used by many different groups from anything from cricket to tennis to community gardening. And so I think it will really offer a lot of opportunities for Madisonians to meet and gather and take advantage of city resources in new and unique ways.
Did that location in a park affect the design of the building? I mean, if I know I'm inside a library and I know there's a park over there, I want to see it, right?
Absolutely, yes. You'll see much more windows in this library than you see in most of our libraries. And obviously, every element was designed to feel like it was a part of the park. Anything from the roof lines to the windows to the outside features to the interior decor.
You mentioned getting buy-in from stakeholders and community members. What went into designing this library and its look and its services and so on in a way that people who live in the service area wanted to use it?
So as part of the East Side plan, our library planner reached out to over 50 different small groups that were already using services on the East Side or that were associated with the East Side of Madison. So this wasn't just for the Imagination Center. It was kind of for a larger look at East Side library service. Multiple planners over that process talked to over 330 people about their individual hopes and dreams. And then we also relied on demographic data and the city's larger planning process to inform the services that we offer. And then once that process started, once we had identified capital funding, we continued to work with the neighborhood residents, with the alders, with the neighborhood associations to find out what was most important to them in this space. And what we found were many of the things we offer in other libraries already, things like meeting rooms and study spaces, things like natural lighting and lots of programs, internet connectivity, you know, access to collections in multiple formats. And then again, that adjacency of being located close to the park pavilion and in the park sparked a lot of interest in health and wellness programming and activities. We have over, I would say, about 40 different partners that we plan to work with in this space right off the bat. And those are longstanding partnerships. Some of them are specific to that particular area, like working with the Sandberg Elementary School, which is just a mile away.
We're talking about the role of libraries as community hubs and Madison's first new library in 25 years with Tana Elias, Madison Public Library Director. The name, Imagination Center, that seems like a different way to think about a library. What goes into that name?
The Imagination Center was at the beginning stages of this project. We weren't sure what all would be in this center. Would it be a library, a park pavilion? At some point, we had talked about a childcare facility. So there were a lot of ideas, a lot of pent-up energy, I would say, that the neighborhood had and thought about all the different things that could be in this space. What we ended up with was a somewhat more traditional library space and the park pavilion and the possibility of using those two spaces as links to the community and working with a lot of different partner groups rather than having them commit to a hard and fast space in that location, if that makes sense.
There are a lot of question marks when it comes to funding for all kinds of public institutions, more question marks than usual. What kind of things go into saying we're going to have this new building, we're going to staff it, and we're going to be able to fund it sustainably?
That is a great question. Certainly things have changed since 2016 when we started seriously talking about acquiring capital funding for this project. And one of the things that you always have to do with any public project is tell the story, tell the importance, tell the value, and then get enough people on board that they're willing to fund it. And so we started by securing funding in 2018 from the City of Madison through the capital budget process. We received additional funding in subsequent years. We have Madison Public Library Foundation has committed $4.5 million to the project. So they have been raising money on our behalf for this project. And then we also received a Flexible Facilities Program grant from the state of Wisconsin's Division of Energy, Housing, and Community Resources. And that was really the capital investment that kind of moved this into the operating stage.
You mentioned alternative energy funding, and there are some unique things that are going into this building, I understand, including the possibility that you'll be able to sell energy from this library maybe in the future. What's going on?
Well, we are using geothermal energy, so that is a portion of the project. It will be a LEED Platinum certified building when it's all done. And then we'll have some solar investment as well, so we'll be depending on how that works out, we'll either sell it out or, use it to offset costs.
Tana, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Tana Elias directs the Madison Public Library. We've been talking about the Imagination Center. When finished, it'll be Madison's first new public library in about a quarter century. That project is under construction with opening day set for September of next year. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummie, Joe Tarr, and Royce Padeswa.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. Thanks for listening to WPR News.